Well, the dark web, it's a place that I don't know a lot about, and I don't know that I want to know a lot about it, because it has been described as an eBay for criminals. It's a place where things that we own that may have been stolen could end up for sale. It's where personal information might be up for sale. What can be done about it? Stilgherrian is freelance journalist, commentator on internet security and cybercrime. Stilgherrian, welcome to Evenings.
Good evening, Deb.
Now, first, can we start with a definition? Like, what is the dark web?
It's a tabloid newspaper term for the parts of the internet that don't want to be found. So I kind of use the analogy of in the physical world. You know, the internet is really just a reflection of all the things humans do in the physical world. And the dark web is just like those back alleys behind pubs where seedy transaction happens. And in the same way that apparently there is pornography on the internet, I don't know whether anyone's aware of that, but in the same way we have red light districts in cities and things of a sexual nature happen there. So the dark web is a term that tabloid newspapers have come up with for just all of these shady and trying to stay hidden communications that happen on the internet. And I want to differentiate that from the deep web, because sometimes people confuse that and they say, oh, the dark web is 90% of the internet. No, what people are talking about there is not the dark web or the dark net, but the deep web. And the deep web is just all of that data on the internet which just happens not to be public. So a scientist has all of the detailed mapping of the moon, or a geologist has a detailed geological survey of Western Australia or something like that. It's not public, but it's a huge amount of data. And the internet, after all, was first created for all of this scientific communication and other stuff. And, you know, you have corporations communicating on the internet too, not wanting to make everything they do public. So that's the deep web. 90% of it is stuff we can't see. All of the websites we see, from big ones like Google to little ones like, I don't know, your corner accountant might have, that's kind of 10% of the stuff. And probably this dark web criminal stuff, like the rest of society, it's a small percentage of what's going on, but it's a very interesting percentage.
Yeah, you're not kidding. So these dark alleys, I love your analogy because you've made it very visual for me, but to what sort of things are in the dark web, apart from things being for sale that are like black market things, like instead of opening your boot up and offering something, you're doing it on the web? What other types of things might we see in the dark web?
Well, the analogy of opening the boot is just that thing, isn't it? It's like the car park or the pub late at night, you know, and you can literally get anything. And there was a huge marketplace, which I think really does deserve to be called the eBay of the dark web, which was called Silk Road. And it's been shut down now, but you could buy anything there, literally illegal drugs, weapons. You could organise an assassination, a killing, you know, a hit. And anything shady in between. Sometimes it was just, well, still illegal, but, you know, 10,000 copies of the new Star Wars movie on Blu-ray or something like that. All of the criminal activity that you can imagine in the physical world, you could find in the online world.
What about human trafficking? Is that also part of the dark web?
Well, I suppose it would be. I mean, we're dealing here with communications that want to be hidden. And I haven't thought that one through myself, but now that you mention it, yeah, obviously we're talking about people organising that who would want to keep their communications quite secret. They would use heavily encrypted and anonymised communication tools, and we should perhaps talk about them in a second. But then, in a sense, so do spies. So do people that we in the West might want to call freedom fighters or dissidents who are fighting against an oppressive regime. You know, it's that old equation, isn't it? Your terrorist is my freedom fighter.
Yeah.
Depending on whose side you're on at the time, and so all of that communication happens, and the anonymizing tools that I mentioned, the biggest and best known is called Tor. which was originally called the Onion Router, and people will hear of the Tor network in relation to the dark web, in relation to spies, in relation to dissidents. It's a communication system which uses the internet to hide your exact location. And how it works is it's fairly simple to explain without getting too much into the technicalities of it. It just means that each bit of communication that you do gets bounced randomly all over the internet amongst all of the other users of the Tor network, maybe a dozen, maybe 20 hops. And then the next time you look at a web page or send an email, it takes a different random path through this network, bouncing all over the place. And so, you know, the first time you access a web page, it bounces around and might come out in Lithuania, and the next time it comes out in Brazil, and the next time it comes out in Iran, or whatever it might be. And on top of that, every little hop it makes within that network is encrypted with a separate encryption key and re-encrypted. So even if you manage to intercept the communications, and even if you can decrypt it in some way, it's like a Russian doll or an onion, which is where its name come from. Tor was the onion router. You know, you open it up, oh, there's another encrypted message inside. Now I have to decrypt that. And again, layers upon layers of secrecy. So it slows everything down, but it makes it very hard to track people's physical location.
Yeah, but who developed the onion router? Where did that come from?
The United States Navy Research Laboratory.
Wow, so how
did the US military designed it so that they could protect the communication of their own agents in the field. And because they wanted to use it, the last thing they wanted was for them to be the only people using it, because then, well, hey, you're using the onion router, you must be an American spy, right? We'll go straight round to your house and arrest you and put a bullet in your head. So they have encouraged its use by dissidents. And it's really quite strange. People think of the American government as this one consistent thing. It's, in fact, this loose constellation of different agencies all roughly heading in the same direction and flying the stars and stripes. But at one level, while the Navy Research Laboratory was trying to keep this communication secret and encouraging mums and dads and dissidents and everyone to use this, so much traffic was happening on the Tor network that their own spy stuff was hidden within that. And then at the same time, American intelligence agencies like the NSA and the CIA are saying, oh, no, we don't want people to encrypt in communications. That's terrible. We can't intercept it.
Oh, no.
So there, in Washington, there's always these kind of turf wars and policy wars between the two organizations, or the two types of organizations, who have very different worldviews of how to use this stuff.
Well, Stilgherrian, what sort of things do you find on the dark web for sale, given that's, you know, like eBay for criminals?
Well, the most common stuff is credit card numbers and things like driver's licenses and passports and so on. And that's the bread and butter of it, to the point now where, I suppose I should say, you know, whenever you hear about a big data breach, like someone gets hold of the Ashley Madison data, or they've broken into Target in the United States, which happened, and they stole millions upon millions of credit card numbers associated with people's email addresses and names and physical addresses, that can be used for credit card fraud. So those kind of things are for sale. But because the credit card companies have got much, much better at detecting fraudulent transactions, like an individual credit card, even if you've got the CCV value, the three digits on the back, and even if you've got the expiry date, it's only worth a few dollars.
Really?
What is it? Yeah. Even now in the United States, like, you'd be lucky to get $5 for a credit card number, because as soon as you use it, you know, it'll turn up on someone's statement and transactions, and it'll get cancelled. What they're really interested in now are two things. One is the kind of passport numbers, home address, dates of birth and stuff. Because if you have that, first, it's much harder to change. And, like, you can't change your date of birth, right? You know, you can't change your home address without an awful lot of expense.
No.
And if you have, and if you have someone's, say, driver's license and passport, and if you've got it physically, if you've stolen that from their handbag or wallet at the airport, or if you've hung around at their house and stolen their mail from Australia Post, and then got all sorts of other stuff. You can then open loan accounts and credit card accounts in that person's name. And identity theft is what it's called.
Yeah.
And you can clock up, you can open a credit card with a $20,000 limit. You go to each bank very quickly and do that. Or you open a loan account. If you do it quickly enough, it won't show up on that person's credit rating. And the first thing you find out about it is 6 months later when someone, well, 2 years later, when someone eventually gets around to knocking on your door with a summons and say, you're coming to court, you owe us $75,000.
And you're saying, what are you talking about?
Exactly, what are you talking about? And that, when it happens to people, shall I say, really stuffs their life around.
No, it would.
Because, you know, the criminals are long since gone. I mean, they've bought goods on the credit cards and so on. The other thing they're after is the master login for your devices. If you use Apple devices, they want your Apple login. If you use Microsoft's, they want your Windows login. Or if you use Android, they want your Google login. Because that is, if you like, the master thing connected with your identity and with your credit card number for so many of your online transactions. And that is of real value. The other thing that's handy for them to get hold of is email logins and passwords, because that's where they can reset the passwords for all of the other online services you use.
Because
if you want to reset Facebook, of course, you know, you get Facebook will send you a link to your email for you to reset your Facebook password. If they can get into your Facebook account, and then they say, aha, you're on holidays overseas in London, say, now we can contact all of your closest friends and relatives, send them a message saying, it's terrible, I'm in London and my purse has been stolen, I don't have any money, the police are being oh so helpful and wonderful, but if you could just send me by wire transfer just a couple of $1,000 just so I can sort things out.
You know, that happened to me a couple of weeks ago.
Wow.
I got one from a relative, you know, who I'm in communication with, saying very, very much that. And luckily I didn't send any money because he wasn't actually overseas.
It was a fraud.
But you are scaring me. I was hoping I wasn't going to be as frightened of the dark web as it sounds, but I am more frightened now I've been speaking to you. So how much of this information is out there?
Well, all of it. I say that very laughingly, but there have been, in the United States, so many data breaches that probably half the population has got some of these details washing around on the internet somewhere. And in Australia, I have to say, we don't know. Because in America and in most parts of Europe and many other parts of the world, there are laws which require any company that's suffered a hack and your data has been stolen, they have to tell you. In Australia, we don't have those laws. And it was on the schedule to be introduced into Parliament before Christmas in the session that's just ended. But there was a lot happening and it's been pushed back another year. So we all assume, and people in the information security industry assume, that it's, you know, most of Australian stuff is out there somewhere anyway, but we just don't know for sure. Now, that said, the banks and the credit card companies are getting much, much better, as I say, at detecting fraud. They're now building things like location services into your mobile apps. And I had it happen the other day. I had to pop down to Melbourne for a conference. And as I exited the airport in Melbourne, my banking app on my phone popped up a message saying, oh, you're in an airport. Are you flying overseas? Have you told us you're flying overseas?
Wow. So just so that you could check in with them and let them know what you're doing.
Exactly that.
That's a good idea.
Even years ago, several years ago now, it must be 5 years ago now, I stepped away from an ATM in Bangkok, having not told my bank. I was travelling to Thailand. I had not even finished turning away from the ATM and putting the notes into my wallet, my wallet into my pocket, when my phone rang and it was the bank security team. Where are you?
Instantaneous. That's incredible.
That's why, well, for example, the big four banks in Australia have been doing a lot of expenditure. I know that on completely updating their system so it can happen in real time. I know that the Commonwealth Bank alone spent something like $2 or $3 billion dollars updating their systems.
Well, the US Navy actually created Tor, so the authorities know Tor is out there, they know it's operating, and they know that what's on it. What can they do to try and close down these sites or find the people behind them? Are they working hard to do that?
They are, and in fact, the biggest one that I mentioned, Silk Road, was closed down, and I forget off the top of my head exactly where the legal process is in prosecuting the guy who's alleged to have been running it. But what had happened is, well, it was really old-fashioned police work, a sting operation. I mean, if you are buying something physical, like you're actually trying to get a physical copy of someone's passport, or you're trying to buy drugs on the internet, or you're arranging for someone to be killed, at some point it has to cross over into the physical world. The drugs have to be delivered. The person who is going to be killed has to be identified and a location given and so on. So law enforcement can infiltrate these places undercover. And indeed, earlier this week, there's been some stories in the Australian media about the extent of these things. You know, things like an Australian passport and driver's license together, if you've got them physically, sells for about $95. And to me,
that's not much.
No, it's not much. It used to be much, much more. But now, as I say, you have to work really quickly. Like, if you bought that, you'd have to move really quite fast to create a fake identity, and that reduces the value. But the law enforcement is in there. There is a lot of speculation that many of the nodes on the Tor network, many of the computers bouncing the data around, are actually being run by intelligence agencies and law enforcement agencies. So even though they may not necessarily be able to decrypt the messages and decode them for the content, they can do clever mathematical tricks and look at the timing of data going to different parts of the network and maybe figure that out. More likely, it's that, as I say, it's old-fashioned police work. They will go undercover. They will try and arrange a transaction. If you can convince the criminals to go to a particular website or click on a particular link outside the hidden network, then you can infect their computer with, well, we won't call it malware, malicious software, we'll call it spyware or surveillance software, because it's the good guys. So, you know, we'll just call the thing a different thing. But you infect their computer with this, and then that can reveal their location, or you can start monitoring their traffic and so on. So that's the kind of things that are happening. It happens slowly because law enforcement has this disadvantage that, of course, they have to gather evidence so it can stand up in a court of law. They can't just come storming in and arrest people and then have, of course, a lawyer throw it out.
Yeah, they want to make sure it sticks. We're talking to Stuart Garion, who is a commentator on internet security and cybercrime, about the dark web. And Shane has called in relation to ATMs overseas. Hi, Shane.
G'day, Dev. How are you?
Well, thank you.
Just your guest was raising some ATM things and whatnot. I just found it intriguing going to places like Indonesia and Thailand and whatnot. ATM machines, you go and get cash out. And the machines have a system that we don't seem to have here. Would you like to continue with the thing? Once you've done the transaction here, you just take your card out and walk away. But in Indonesia and Thailand, it has a system where it says, do you want to continue? And you take your card out and it stays up on the screen, and then someone jumps into the booth after you and can potentially just go and drain your account, because all your details are already in there. But that you're continuing the transaction.
Shane's right there with that problem, Deb, with some ATMs around the world. Most of those in Australia, and Australia, I should say, is incredibly technologically advanced in its banking system. We're way ahead of the United States, and in many ways Australian banking is in the lead. And we've programmed most of our machines, as Shane pointed out, as soon as your cash is about to come out, the first thing it does is spit your card out so you don't forget your card. And then as soon as cash is delivered, you are logged out so that nothing else can happen. But he's right. In some parts of the world, there are some ATMs where, okay, you've got your cash now, would you like to do anything else? And you're kind of still logged in. So at that point, someone can give you a thump on the head and take your cash, and they're still logged in and can empty your account.
Exactly, wow.
Poor design. Australia's moved on from there, but there's some older and less well-programmed ATMs around the world that still have that flaw.
Yeah, thanks, Shane, for bringing that to our attention. Mm. We're almost out of time, but is it the case that some of the people that actually send out malware and viruses and operate on the dark web, actually the people that turn up at hackers' conventions hoping to get a job in the legitimate security business?
Look, that is bound to happen. It's certainly well known within the security business that, yes, there are the black hats who are definitely the criminals, the white hats who are definitely working on our side and testing networks and working for banks and agencies and so on. And there are certainly people they call the grey hats who are, shall we say, ethically more ambiguous in terms of who they work for. So some of the hacking conferences where people are exchanging skills, oh, yes, they're a wonderfully subtle kind of place where everything is not always as it seems.
And Stilgarian, in terms of us trying to make sure our stuff doesn't end up there, obviously we need to try and follow the right guidance that we get from agencies about how to create our passwords, mm-hmm. et cetera, rather mm-hmm. than doing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, et cetera.
Yep. It's long and complex passwords now. The whole thought of, we used to be told, oh, make them 6 or 8 characters and put letters and numbers in. No, make them much longer and random. Definitely get password management software. It'll only cost you $20 or $30 in that ballpark to get some software that you can run on your computer and your phone that will create a long and random password for it that's different for every different thing. And, you know, the worst thing people can do is use the same password in different places, because if one place gets hacked and those passwords are out there, then the bad guys will soon try and use that same password and log into other places too. Mm. So, you know, get ahead of them and do that. Obviously, take care of your devices. Make sure you have a passcode on your phone and computer so that, you know, people can't just walk up to it and use it. Because they will, you know, you will lose it. You will lose your phone. Everyone loses their phone eventually. And, follow those simple steps in your way ahead. And as soon as you hear that someone you've done business with has been hacked, as soon as you hear that there's software that needs updating, do it.
Wow. Okay, great advice. Thanks, Stilgarian. Very interesting to hear. I'm very worried about the dark web now, fascinating at the same time.
Yeah, look, Deb, I will say that is happening, but at the same time, people make dozens of transactions a day. There are billions and billions of dollars moving around the internet every day, perfectly safely and perfectly happily. So the bad stuff is a small percentage of what's going on. And for individuals, not so much for businesses, but for individuals, you know, your losses are covered by the bank, remember?
Exactly. So just claim them.
Yeah. Yeah. Because the banks are, you know, terrible, can't make a profit.
They're certainly loaded up here in Australia, so I'm not at all surprised that they're ahead, way ahead when it comes to better security, because I've certainly got the money to do it. Stilgarian, it's been great talking with you. Thanks for joining us on the evening show tonight.
Pleasure, Deb.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
Same to you.